Welcome back to the Purity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Archinall. Today, we are honored to welcome Rick Reynolds. He's the founder and president of AffairRecovery.com. It's an online platform rooted in real-world healing for individuals and couples devastated by infidelity. Rick isn't just a clinician. He has lived it. In 1984, his own marriage was upended by his betrayal, and the struggle to find meaningful help drove him to develop the tools that now guide thousands toward restoration and hope. He holds a master's in social work, is a clinical member of the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapists, and has counseled over 2,000 couples in private practice, while 3,000 plus individuals have completed the Affair Recovery's online curriculum. His work emphasizes not shame or blame, but vulnerability, accountability, and authentic transformation. He is my kind of dude. All right, today we are going to talk about infidelity through the lens of men, what challenges they face in recovery, how to rebuild trust and identity, and what real hope looks like on the other side. This is a fun conversation, as much fun as you can have on this topic. Thanks for joining us on the Purity Podcast. Rick, I am so excited to have you on the Purity Podcast today. I've really been looking forward to this. Actually, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I just hadn't reached out to you until recently, and you said yes immediately to jumping on. So thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
I am so glad to be here. And it's great at the end of the holiday season. We can still see the stockings behind you there.
Yep, yep. And some of the kids didn't bring theirs back. You can see two missing. So, you know, they're still up in their room trying to rifle through all the goodies, I guess.
Absolutely.
So I'm really excited about this conversation. And I'm going to do this a little differently than I do some. I'm going to try to rapid fire through about 15 questions, 16 questions, something like that. But if we see a squirrel and we decide to chase it, has some meat on it, then let's do it, right? Like this is what I really want to get out of this is what you like to talk about the most. And I'd also just like to give you a second to talk about the new podcast, because I've been listening to y'all's new podcast. I was shocked that y'all hadn't had one before, and I'm so excited that you have one now, because there's some super talented people on there, not just, you know, with a great voice or a great face, but just great wisdom. And so would you mind just taking a few minutes to talk about that?
Well, this is actually our third attempt to try to launch a podcast. Okay. And we started, I think the first one, we kind of got going a little bit back in 2017, and that didn't fly. And then last summer, we started something, well, summer before last, in 2024, where we were interviewing couples who are in recovery. But that was going to be, we were doing all of that by Zoom. And then we hired Jeremy, who's our new, Jeremy Edlin, who's our new content director. And he said, here's how we need to do the podcast. And so we set up the expert panel. And I'll tell you, I love and I hate it. A lot of times, like, Tracy makes me feel so like I don't have a gift of mercy. John is so blooming philosophical, you know. Lori's practical, and I'm going, why am I even in this panel? But I think it's probably been that way for all of us. It's been a lot of fun getting to play off each other and then having Jeremy facilitate everything.
How do you deal with those, like the personalities there? Because, I mean, you could ask one question and all four of you probably have a fantastic answer, right? Like, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that piece?
Well, what I try to do is listen to what everybody else is saying first so I can play off it. I don't want to go first. I mean, you could look really dumb.
Rick is completely wrong. Really, what he meant to say is...
Well, that's the problem is that, and as we've got, the more we're doing, we're kind of finding out, we don't mind disagreeing at all. So, I don't totally. I think I would look at it this way. In fact, I thought Tracy was going to come out of her seat. I forget which episode it was, and somebody was saying that their mate wasn't responding well to them. And what could they, their kids, it was something about their kids, and they had tried this, and their kids weren't accepting them. And so I gave a practical thing they could do, and I thought Tracy was going to go, you crazy narcissist. I mean, why is it about you? This is about you? Them. What is wrong with you that this is what? And I went, oh, Tracy, you're right. I didn't even go there. I was just trying to be helpful. And she's going, let's get to the root problem here.
Yeah, exactly. That's so funny. That's so good. That's probably another question we could have added to this list of things is, you know, like I hear so many guys, you know, kind of wanting that high five, not necessarily expecting the high five, but wanting it, sometimes expecting it. I'm like,
sometimes expecting it. And that's pretty diagnostic if they're expecting it. You know, one of the things we do, if I do an empathy exercise and somebody's going, tell me what a great job I did on the empathy exercise, I'm going, I don't think they need to tell you what a great job you did on the empathy exercise because you just flunked the entire empathy exercise.
Exactly. All right, we're going to jump in this. And again, you can spend as much or as little time on each of these. I just wanted to rapid fire kind of through these questions and get your thoughts. So no particular order here either, but you've worked with men from all walks of life, CEOs to soldiers, right? What common mindset or belief do you see that tends to block men from real healing early on?
Wow, that is a great question. I think it's always our image. That is the primary thing, because especially if you're worried about what the other, well, fear is a big one. Mm-hmm. So that's primarily why people lie. One of the things that Stephanie would do, I'd say I was sorry all the way back in the 1984, 85. And she'd say, yeah, you're sorry, all right. You're just sorry. I'm pissed off. You're just sorry. How much is this going to cost you? And she would go on and on. And so I would call those sorry fights.
Yeah.
And it finally dawned on me when I was reading 2 Corinthians 7, where it says, worldly sorrow leads to death, but godly sorrow leads to repentance, which leads to salvation, which leaves no regret. Mm. And I remember reading that going, how could I ever not have regret? And that's when it dawned on me, what's the difference? Because godly sorrow, which leads to repentance, which leads to salvation, which leaves no regret, is about grief. I grieve over what my actions have cost another person. I grieve over what my actions have cost God. I'm not concerned about what it's going to cost me, but most guys are far more concerned about what it's going to cost them if they're honest, if they really face things, if they really own it, if they really surrender, if they let go of control.
Yeah.
And because of that, it's that fear. So they try to manage their mate by the flow of information. Mm. And they even try to manage their relationship with God by what they'll admit, what they'll even own with other people. And ultimately, you have to not be worried about what it's going to cost you. Mm-hmm. That's that self-centeredness. You've got to be worried about what you're costing other people. And there's got to be a desperateness to love others, not to control and manipulate others by the flow of information. Yeah, so I think that's probably the biggest one right there. People are afraid.
Yeah, yeah, that's so good. Next question. Why do men struggle so profoundly with shame, maybe even some shame spirals, and defensiveness, even when intellectually they know they're wrong, right? They know that they were the one that's wrong, and yet they deal with this defensiveness and shame. What do you think?
I think we have at the core such a strong piece that's about our performance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the feminist movement has a little bit to do with it. I don't know if it was better before the feminist movement, maybe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, men for so long have been actually belittled, I think, you know, for a long time. In fact, the largest selling product that Hallmark cards had were the men bashing cards. Mm-hmm. You know, you can make Homer Simpson, you can make fun of guys. Now, if you did the same thing to women, you would die. But it was okay to make fun of guys and see guys as not being all that cool. And so men don't want to be seen that way. So they really work way too much. I think shame became a kind of almost ingrained because we were made fun of. And, you know, to me, it's all about Jesus anyway. I mean, there's nothing that I can do that Jesus hasn't already done except sing hymns. That's what Watchman Nee said. So, I mean, ultimately, I just have to let go of control to gain control. And that's the piece, paradoxically, I think that guys don't see. As long as you're trying to appear better than you are, there's going to be an issue. In fact, in John chapter 3, you remember when Jesus is saying to Nicodemus, for God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son, that whoever believes in him will receive eternal life. And then right after that, and this is my translation, he says this. So bottom line, Nick, light came into the world, but men love darkness rather than light. Everyone, you know, who does evil won't come into the light because they're afraid they'll be exposed for who they really are. But those who do truth, and to me, truth is Jesus. I mean, he's the way and the truth and the life. Those who do truth come into the light so it can be seen plainly if there's anything good in them. It has to be God. It's not even you to begin with. And ultimately, I think that was Satan's original, you know, lie that he presented to Adam and Eve. It was, you can be like God. You can be good. And we've grown up in a culture since the fall that says it's about being good, not about being a not. I mean, Enoch walked with God and then he was not because God took him. And my whole thing is, if I can be a not and not worry about my pride, my ego, or my shame, I can abide in the vine and do anything. But apart from him, I can't do anything.
Do you think from the shame perspective, and then I'll ask you another question about the defensive part, but do you think the shame piece may have something to do with some men wanting to show their spouse how much, how sorry they are? And so they just shame. I can remember saying to Tim Mavergeorge, my therapist, I said to him, you know, sometimes Tim, this is year in or so, I'll take myself back to that moment when I told my kids what I'd done, and I had a written statement that my wife had, you know, we had agreed on that I could read, would have done things very differently, by the way. So if you're listening to this podcast, like, don't do this necessarily. I mean, this isn't the best way to do it, but, I told Tim, I said, I'll take myself back to that time when I told him, just to make myself feel that pain that I in just the destruction that I created. And he looked at me and said, Chris, you don't have to shame yourself to stay humble and broken.
Right.
And do you feel like some men deal with that shame because they feel like it's a way to show their spouse, hey, I really feel bad and I'm really in this? And if so, what does that, good or bad, does that do to the spouse?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. The first thing, shame makes you 100% totally self-centered. I mean, if I'm walking across the kitchen and I'm carrying a sharp knife and I slip and I cut Stephanie's stomach open and eviscerate her and her intestines are falling out, and then I run across the kitchen going, oh my God, what's wrong with me? I'm so stupid. While she's bleeding to death, it looks a little crazy, right? But that's exactly what our shame does. It makes it all about us while they're dying, and we can't be over here to help them because we somehow feel like we deserve to be beat up. And with shame, there are two questions I always ask. Well, there's actually kind of three things I look at. One, what's the lie you believe? And sometimes it's like, I'll have somebody come and they'll say, well, this is just unforgivable. And I go, okay, let's at least have a little integrity and honesty here. Because I know plenty of people who have forgiven this, who've been able to forgive themselves. So it's not that it's unforgivable. Mm-hmm. In honesty, you have to admit you're just choosing not to forgive yourself. And that's fine if that's what you want to do. But be honest, it's a choice. The second is what's the secondary gain of hanging on to the shame, which is one I think you pointed out, that if I can at least show my mate that I'm beating myself up, that somehow it makes them think I'm truly sorry or something. And the third that creates it, I think, is an inner vow. Because when we say something like, I will never do this. I'm not going to ever be like my dad, or I'm never going to be like this. And then suddenly we're there because God allowed us to fall, because he's not interested in me getting it right. He's interested in me doing it with him. There's just a total difference in what, you know, I think the spiritual life is about. We think it's about being good. And that was the state after the fall. Before the fall, it was about being in a relationship with the Lord and letting God be the meter of needs. We weren't trying to be like God. Yeah. We were just trying to be in relationship with him.
Yeah, yeah. From a defensiveness perspective, I feel like a lot of that is pretty self-centered as well when we're defensive. And I feel like probably some of that has to do with the man feeling like, you know, because the men seem to heal faster because they just vomited everything out. So, of course, they feel better already, right? And then the person with the vomit all over them is not feeling
so
great.
They're trying to climb out from underneath the dump truckload of whatever.
Exactly. And so, but then, you know, oftentimes these guys, you know, I talk to guys who get defensive and, you know, will just defend themselves. And, you know, I've had enough kind of thing. Like, you know, what is it about, what would you say about defensiveness? Like, what would you tell a guy who's been a lot of time being defensive?
Well, maybe I'd ask them, do you want to quit being defensive? I mean, do you know why you're defensive? And it's mostly because we're trying to protect our own image still. We're far more concerned about how we're seen or what our intent was, trying to show that we still have some value or some worth, rather than, and we're focused on the wrong thing. I think if we're defensive, it's probably a pretty good sign that we're trying to save something rather than letting go of something.
Mm-hmm.
I always, first off, to get out of defensiveness, I tell guys, when your mate is speaking, don't listen for what they say that's wrong. Instead, listen for what they're saying that's right and agree with what's right. Do right spotting, not wrong spotting. You'll never be defensive. Just agree. I mean, they may only have 5% right, but you can at least go, oh, yeah, you're right about that. But it's also, I think, this fear that we're trying to prove to them that it's, you know, we're minimizing. And really, I remember telling Stephanie, Chris, one of the best things that the Lord showed me was, look, my goal is not to try to save this marriage. Because if my goal is to save this marriage, it is not pragmatically smart for me to be honest with you. Why in the world would I be telling you everything that's going to make you want to drop kick me through the goalpost of life? Mm-hmm. But my goal is to become who God made me to be. And perhaps if I become that man, you'd be interested in being with me. I mean, right now, I don't blame you for wanting to divorce me. I would divorce me.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
You know, but maybe I can become who God wants. And if that's my goal, then I think we can have something very different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's good. Where do you, and you've kind of hit on this already, but if you have anything else to add, where do fear, pride, and avoidance show up most in men's behavior during recovery, and how can they start to work through these honestly?
You know, in 12 step, we talk about rigorous honesty.
Yeah.
And I remember someone telling me once, and it was really funny, he'd gone to a meeting and he decided he was going to, for the first time in his life, be really honest. And he left the meeting and he said, I was just banging my head against the steering wheel going, I'm not even sure if I was honest when I was trying to be honest. I mean, I have lied so much in my life. I couldn't even tell if I was. And so then he said, you know, the next thing I could think of is I need to kill myself. He said, I just deserve to die. And so he said, I drove to my sponsor's house and I told him what was going on. And I said, hey, you know, I tried to be honest at the meeting. I'm not even sure if I was honest. I think I just need to die. And the guy said, well, but you're insane. Why would you know? And he went, oh, you're right. I'm insane. Mm-hmm. And I think that at one level, we think that we ought to be able to do it. And I think that apart from him, I can't do anything. So I don't get in that place of being all wound up around the axle. I just go, you know, if I don't sin, if I get it right, that's proof positive there's a God, because I don't think I can do anything if there's not a God.
Yeah. I think it's the joke of how do you know when an addict is lying? When they start talking, right? So, all right. So as you know, the Purity Podcast is for men, primarily men who are dealing with compulsive sexual behaviors or sexual addiction. If they're married, they may have cheated on their wife, and regardless of whether it was a person or through acting out with magazines and pornography and so forth. But what are the first non-negotiable actions he needs to take after discovery day? And how does he know if he's actually progressing?
There's a Hebrew term, Chris, called teshuva. And that's kind of their term for repentance. And the first sign of repentance is you stop the behavior. And it doesn't make any difference as to why you stop the behavior, but the behavior stops. Because if you don't stop the behavior, if you're not working at, if you don't see it as wrong, because I've got a lot of people who would, gosh, they're ambivalent still about stopping the behavior. And you have to first, it sounds kind of crazy, people coming to meetings, but denial is a big deal. I mean, we don't see, I think, the harm we're doing, the destructiveness to others and to self. And it's not in a shame sort of way. I just don't think shame does us any good whatsoever. But it's going, okay, that's not who I am. And not who I, that's just not me. One of the things that I think changed me the most personally in my recovery was recognizing that I'm a new creation in Christ. And ultimately, that behavior is not me. I think the biggest mistake, and this is one of the things I got from your book here, but it was reinforcing this one concept. It's why are you doing what you're doing? I mean, I don't do things to be acceptable to God. If that's my motivation, then I'm back in that transactional, not transformational, right? I mean, I always ask people, would you like to be more acceptable to God? And they'll go, yeah. And I'll say, do you think Jesus was acceptable to God? Yes. Is Christ your life? Yes. Then are you acceptable to God? Because what makes you acceptable to God? Christ's life or what you're doing? So I don't do things to be acceptable. I do things because I learn what my identity is, and I do things because I am acceptable. And that is 180 degrees in terms of the motivation. And what you said in the book here is if you do the right thing for the wrong reason, you're still going to end up at the wrong place. You can't do it to be acceptable. You do it because it's not who you are.
Right.
You do it because you are acceptable and you recognize that you have a new identity. And that's transformational.
That's awesome. I wished I would have written that. That sounds great. That's awesome. Maybe I'll rewrite. I think you said that better than I did.
Go ahead and put that in there.
Okay, I'm rifling through some of these here just to check, see which ones I want to hit. What are the biggest communication mistakes men make after an affair or after the discovery, or and what should they practice instead?
Well, I think one of the biggest communication mistakes he makes is not communicating. I think that we have this tendency to think if our mate's not saying anything, that everything's okay. And it's not. You know, what I tell people, if you will take responsibility for their pain, for your mate's pain, for your wife's pain, they won't have to. So whenever you think there's a reminder, you're far better off to immediately go, hey, honey, I'm sorry. That must have just really bothered you. Are you okay? What can I do? It's acknowledging it, mm-hmm. not running to the storm shelter thinking that maybe they're going to explode. It's leaning in instead of, you know, ultimately leaning out and avoiding. So we try to avoid, and that's the worst thing you can do.
Yeah. And I, you know, one thing that I feel like when I talk to men, one of the things too is this idea that this is going to be fixed faster than they, than it will be. And so when it goes, when it feels like we've gone back to day one, and sometimes it does, right? Like sometimes there could be trigger or a situation that happens, or you can just say something that you didn't even intend to be anything that will take them back to day one. And then the response is, I thought we were past that. And I would tell these guys, that is not the response. The response is just what you said, validating their emotions and affirming them and saying, I understand why you feel that way. I remember early on telling my wife, I don't want any shortcuts in this. You have the rest of your life to ask me questions mm-hmm. that come to your mind. You have the rest of your life to have feelings when you're triggered. You have the rest of your life to approach me on any of these things. Don't ever feel like we've gotten to a point where all is forgiven, all is forgotten, we're moving on. And, you know, now, because I don't want right. you having resentment, building up resentments towards me for not being able to share where you are on the journey as well. So no shortcuts, right? Like there are no shortcuts.
Right. And at Fair Recovery, you know, one of the things we say is it's an 18 to 24 month timeline, depending on how you're spending the time. Mm-hmm. But at a year, I can promise you it will go back to being the way it was at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And so it will go way downhill, and you'll have thought everything is going great. And suddenly, you know, that reminder of that 1 year anniversary takes him right back to ground zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you think that we haven't made any progress when in reality you've made huge progress. And hopefully yeah. if you've really grown, you're not getting upset with them or impatient with them when they begin to struggle because of the trauma. Instead, you're responding to them, and you've got, you know, to me, community for a couple is also everything. It's not just mm-hmm. the individual work, because, you know, our model is – you begin by trying to stabilize the relationship or put it in a safe container mm-hmm. by working with other couples. And then you're doing your individual work. They're doing their trauma, betrayal trauma work. You're doing your recovery work. You know, when you get out to 18 to 24 months, you know, people will either have really been authentic in their work and growing mm-hmm. and getting rid of their shame and dealing with their developmental trauma, their betrayal trauma. And yeah. at that point, you're going to have something far better than you ever had mm-hmm. before.
Yeah. So on that, how can men listen to their spouse's pain without shutting down, defending, or rationalizing?
You know, we're not very comfortable with our mate's pain. We want to fix it. Mm-hmm. And it's that ability to not try to fix it. I think that, again, now I'll go back to group work. So it's when we have couples working together, either online or on our EMS weekend or our EMS online, you can see the pain of the other couples, and it's not as personal. And so you learn to tolerate it far better because of that community than you can if you're just you and your mate and y'all are isolated and not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's interesting neurobiologically. In community, the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that helps us emotionally regulate, is offline when you're in a group, because God made us to be embedded in community. And that's why when we can put like five couples together and have them working, the guy learns not to be responsive or not to be reactive. Maybe responsive, mm-hmm. yes, not reactive. And he sees, it's almost like you have other people helping. It's called load sharing in terms of social mm-hmm. baseline theory. And so it's much easier to do it because of that community than it is if it's just the two of you being isolated, because you don't have anybody setting an example. you don't have other couples helping to carry that emotional load.
Yeah, that's good. What are some daily habits you've seen men do that help build trust over time?
Well, the first one is to be trustworthy, you have to be consistent 90%+ of the time. So the tendency, first thing we do is we make a mistake of trying to tell our mate what they want to hear rather than just being authentic and honest. In other words, I would tell Stephanie, I'd know she'd want me home by 7. So I'd say, okay, I'll be home at 7. And that was possible as long as I drove 97 miles an hour. I didn't catch any lights. I got away from the office. Nothing happened. And so, but when I wouldn't show up at 7, that was the worst thing that could possibly happen. So that's one aspect, is a lack of trustworthiness, and that's just a lack of consistency. The second one is not 84% of betrayed spouses in one of our surveys said that the one thing their mate did that made them feel honorable, made them feel like they weren't being a fool, is when they saw their mate working a strong recovery program, when they saw them working at not being that other person again. And whether that's, you know, your 12-step work, whether it's doing Hope for Healing through a Fair Recovery or something like that, it's when they see them working and not being that other person, that gives them hope. When they say, I won't do it again, that does nothing. And they recognize, you know, that brokenness. You know, are you really concerned for them and what you've cost them? Or are you really concerned again about what it's going to cost you?
That's so good. What do you think one habit is or a mindset shift that would have the biggest impact on a man's long-term recovery and relational health?
I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, Chris, is apart from him, I can do nothing. Yeah. I mean, what made my recovery, and I know it was the same for you in the long run, Stephanie could see the spiritual growth I was going through. I mean, me and the Lord, I mean, that was pretty much what I had, because I wasn't sure I was going to have my marriage, but I was sure that I didn't ever want to be that other guy again. And I remember it's so much about surrender and letting go. 4 weeks into our recovery, I was driving to Nashville, Tennessee. And I was, this is probably worse than texting and driving, but I was memorizing Philippians 3 while I was driving. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning. I had my Bible, you know, my steering wheel back in the day. Not safe. And
I think that's Jesus take the wheel.
But exactly right. But it was that passage that went, for whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss. What's more, I consider everything lost compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I've lost all things, you know, so that I can gain Christ. And it says, you know, all I want is to know Christ, to share with him in the suffering of his death, to become like, or share in his suffering, to become like him in death, so that I can be the one who experiences the fresh newness of life of those who are alive from the dead in Christ. And as I was memorizing that, I remember the Lord saying to me, what does that mean? And I kind of stopped. And he said, what about past tense? And I went, past tense. I guess that's all the things I hold up that show I have value, my historically, the things I've accomplished. He said, are you willing to consider all of that just rubbish, garbage, compared to just getting to know me and to be with me? And I said, absolutely. Because, I mean, my reputation was already shot, right?
Yeah.
And then he said, what about present tense? And I said, well, that's, you know, my marriage, my bank account, my house, my possessions, my guitar. Ooh, my guitar. I don't know. I have a really good guitar. Anyway, and he said, are you willing to consider that all garbage compared to just getting to know me and to be with me? And I said, absolutely, because I figured I was going to lose everything anyway at that point. Yeah. I wasn't sure I was going to be married. And then he said, what about future tense, Rick? And man, I hit a brick wall going about 90 miles an hour, because my future tense was all my dreams of how life was supposed to be. Was I willing to give all of that up compared to just for the opportunity of knowing Jesus and becoming like him? And, you know, I think it's surrendering the things we think we need to make us happy, understanding that the only thing that ultimately is going to make us happy is going to be Jesus anyway. Mm-hmm. And that whole thing of letting go of how life ought to be and saying, okay, Lord, you take it and make my life the way you want it to be. It's giving up control, as I said earlier, to gain control. Mm. And when you're willing to do that and you're really pursuing God, for most women, that's really attractive. Mm-hmm. Because it's not the same, it's not life as usual. You know, you're not pursuing the same thing you once pursued. Yeah. And they see that difference.
Yeah. One of the things that I find interesting at times is that it seems like a lot of men that are in relationships that are married, still married, I see that they are doing the work. Now, whether how honestly and, you know, intentional they are about it, you know, all I see is what I see. But their spouse is not engaged in any kind of therapy because the idea of, hey, I'm not the one who cheated. You know,
this is
his mess. This is what he did. It's on him to fix it, right? Like, and yet one of the things I'm so grateful for to this day is that my wife embraced therapy because she understood the need for the trauma that happened. I mean, the Body Tells the Truth book, right? Like, I mean, she knew that she was going through some serious stuff. And so she saw the importance of therapy and getting involved in some counseling. What can a guy do to encourage his wife to seek therapy and to seek counseling? Is there anything they can do, or are they just in the doghouse and have to figure it out on their own?
No, I think, again, the way at least we set it up at A Fair Recovery is I have guys tell their mates, look, I don't care if you do therapy. I want you to do this course with me because I want to learn how to have empathy, and I need you to be able to do that. And, you know, take from it what you want, but if you want me to learn to grow in empathy, this is the way we do it.
That's really good. Whoever's listening, pause right now and write that down, because that's really, really good. I mean, that is super good way to approach that with, this is about you. It's not about, I mean, it's about you and me healing, but like, that is so good. All right.
Continue. Yeah. Because even, and I can say to them, you know, even if you decide to divorce me, I'm still going to be a better father. It's going to help me be a better this. It's going to help me be a better that. It's amazing how many people come into our program, Chris, that as couples, that they've already filed for divorce. They're right at the divorce. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the last thing they're going to do because they just go, well, at least we can say we gave it a good faith effort.
Yeah.
And typically, again, when they get in that community, it just changes. They suddenly have hope again. Yeah. And it's amazing because we've tracked people. We've been doing a longitudinal study. We just did one with over 20,000 course participants. I think it's 20,600 over the last 14 years. And we show specifically how depression, how PTSD, how anxiety have continued to heal as a result of being a part of community. And we've only gotten out on the longitudinal study, we're out at about 36 months, even with 20,000, because you have to have people filling out those surveys for that, you know, for entire 3 years. But it's pretty amazing to watch that people actually heal. And I think a lot of times, you know, it's crazy, and I hear you. I know it's frustrating if a wife isn't willing to do something. You're kind of going, I mean, I'll do the work, but I can't heal you. And I always use the analogy, if I'm texting and we have a wreck and Stephanie breaks both of her legs, I would love to be able to do the physical therapy for her so that she could walk again. But I can't.
Yeah. Right.
If she's ever going to walk again, she's the one that has to do the physical therapy. And
that's really good.
But you can't convince them to do that, but you might be able to convince them to do the community to help you. And if that happens, most likely they're going to begin, well, the scores are really obvious how much PTSD has changed just by being part of community. Because that's ultimately how they used to heal or treat PTSD was community, not, you know, I mean, we've got some great new techniques. And like I can take somebody with super high betrayal trauma scores, and in 3 hours, I can cut that by 50%. So they're not even having those intrusive thoughts anymore.
Yeah. You do that through EMDR or what kind of techniques are you using?
I use a special technique called peripheral eye stimulation. It's going to sound funny, but ultimately what I'm doing is taking the traumatic memory because it's stored in the posterior cingulate cortex, I'm not trying to get too geeky here, but it's not stored in the hippocampus in the normal way a memory stored. So betrayal memories are stored in the PCC, which means they don't have a timestamp. And that's the problem. When they have those intrusive thoughts, they're experiencing as if it happened yesterday. And all I'm doing with the technique I use is I'm converting it from a PCC memory to a hippocampal memory so it fades into the past. But you can imagine if somebody's got 15 or 20 memories that every time they get triggered, they're living back 5 years ago. They're not even in 2025. They're in 2020. How do you ever move forward if they keep reliving everything? Yeah. And being able to convert those memories, I mean, you can heal, but community helps with that also.
That's great. Last question on this on the, for now, and then I will ask you if you have any questions that I didn't ask that you would love to answer. What do you say to a guy who just can't stay sober? Like he just cannot find any sobriety, and clearly, like, even if he may be single and think it's not impacting anyone, but being married is impacting his relationship. And especially if he's now being rigorously honest, he's sharing that. And it's just like death by a thousand cuts for his wife. What do you say to a guy who just can't find any length of sobriety?
So when I was growing up, my dad was executive vice president of a home building company. So he had me framing by age 16. And I remember when I first got on this framing crew, Chris, I went out to Montgomery Ward's. I know you're probably old enough to remember Ward's.
Yep.
And I got me this 22-ounce hammer, framing hatchet. And I took that to the job site. And I'm watching these World War II vets, because that's how old I am. These guys were all on the crew from World War II. And they had these 16-ounce, long, red-handled, hickory-handled hammers, plum hammers. And they would drive nails like this. It'd be boop-bam, boop-bam, two hits. And I'm swinging this big old hammer, four or five times to get the nail in. And I finally asked one of the guys, I said, how in the world, your hammer is not even as heavy as mine, are you driving nails with two hits? And they said, well, it's simple. Did you ever study science? I mean, what are they teaching you youngsters these days? I mean, don't you know that E equals MC squared? And I went, what does that mean? He says, it means that speed is twice as important or squared important to mass. You're using mass, we're using speed, because with these long handles, we have leverage and it's lighter, but it's going so fast, it's more effective than using more mass. So here's, and I say that story to say this, when it comes to being sober, I tell people I have a 16-ounce hammer that I can use. And I can usually drive the nail with a 16-ounce hammer. But if that doesn't work, I've also got a 22-ounce hammer that I can hit the problem with. And if that doesn't work, I have a 4-pound sledge that, you know, it's pretty good. And I also have an 8-pound sledge and I have a 10-pound sledge. I don't like to swing the 10-pound or the 8-pound, but if that's what it's going to take to get you sober, that's what we're going to use. Mm-hmm. And I think that people don't continue trying to figure out what they need to do. But I don't know that I've ever had somebody not get sober if they really want to get sober. Mm-hmm. It's just that it may not work the same way for them that it does for other people, but there are definitely other techniques that people can use that they may need to use to get sober.
Is it insensitive to just say to a guy, you don't have the want to? Like,
I tell them all the time. I mean, I love you, but you know, you're not ready. Yeah. You are not going to quit because you are not willing to pay the cost.
Yes.
You know, you're just not.
Yeah. Wow. All right. I appreciate this time. This has been awesome. Is there anything we didn't cover a question I didn't ask that you love to answer or anything like that? And I've got one last question that's not recovery related, but anything I miss?
Well, I think that, Castamonia is a great program. If people need to find something, do something. Don't think that you're going to make it by white knuckling it, that you're going to make it on your own. And the problem is, I always say, people can get all the sobriety they want.
Yeah.
But the only currency they're going to really be able to use to get sober is going to be their pride, their shame, and their ego. And if they'll give those three things up, you'll always get sober.
Mm,
but it's going to be pride, shame, or ego that keeps somebody continuing to act out, because there's some place in there that, and they may be having trouble dealing with that. I mean, I think that I send people to intensives where they do a lot of psychodrama. They do a deep dive into developmental trauma.
Mm.
And, you know, I think that being a part of community, and it doesn't have to be expensive and it doesn't have to be hard. Again, at Affair Recovery, one of the things that I think for most couples, we offer like a year's worth of treatment for around $700, which is fairly inexpensive.
Yeah, it is.
Unless you can try seeing a therapist and see, but once they do the course, we keep that couple in a small group. And then again, while people go out and do Castamonia, whether they do Hope for Healing, whether they're Harboring Hope, whatever type of work, but they need to continue to do the work. And so to me, it's pride, I think, a lot of times that keeps people from coming in and doing things, because our shame, they don't want to admit. Of course, that's why we made everything anonymous, so nobody even knows your name. They don't know your email address, where you live. Well, they know your first name. But I think that it is so shameful for a lot of people, and just as much for the betrayed spouse. And I think this is a concept that we don't understand as men. When we cheat on our wives, we have dishonored them, and it feels dishonorable to stay with somebody who dishonors you. I mean, it's really, really, really hard for those betrayed spouses, because a lot of them also made an inner vow that they weren't ever going to be with somebody who cheated on them. And now they feel like a loser if they're even trying to sit there, and if they agree to work with you, they feel like they've compromised themselves. And that inner vow that I'm never going to be with somebody who cheats on me, they have to break that, you know, inner vow. Just like I had to break the inner vow that I'm not going to end up being like my dad. And then when I'm like my dad, I go, well, I really am a failure, you know?
Yeah.
But maybe God knew exactly how I needed to be. He knew the right circumstances ultimately to bring me to him, what it was going to take.
Yeah.
And it wasn't going to be an intellectual exercise. It was going to be me failing, because you only get to God through failure.
Yeah.
I always say, I know God's physical address. It's at the end of your rope.
Yeah, that's right. That's so good. I know you've got a lot of resources at Affair Recovery. You mentioned a couple of them, Harboring Hope and Hope for Healing. You have the EMS online guide for both spouses, I guess. And do you have some, I think you have some free resources as
well.
Oh
yeah. Yeah. First Steps Boot Camp. That's really interesting. The First Steps Boot Camp, as well as the Affair Analyzer, those things are, so one of the biggest problems is when things blow up initially, you know, couples will split up really quickly if there's not an intervention. And the reason we even put the First Steps Boot Camp out there is it gave couples a way of, it normalized what they're going through. It gave them a way to talk about it. It facilitates a conversation. And it's interesting, couples who get through the first 2 days of that boot camp actually do really well. Yeah. Because they've suddenly gotten past that piece and that it's beginning to normalize. Because if you think about it, again, it's an ascribed shame for the betrayed spouse. They feel so much shame because of what their mate has done. And the only place that you're going to feel no shame, and you know this from your groups, is when you're with your tribe. When you're with other guys who are going through this, you don't feel ashamed. Yeah. You're normal there. Yeah. And so when we can put those couples together, that's where they get to be normal.
Amen. Yeah, so good. So
and
good.
That's huge, being with yeah. other people, both betrayed and wayward spouses, where you're not, you know, alone. In fact, you're like everybody else there.
Yeah, so good. Okay, last question. When I interview people on the podcast, I love to ask them one question. It's not recovery related. It's just, I love telling stories. I'm a storyteller, and one of the best ways to communicate for me is through telling stories. You've told several, you know, just about the, you're driving a nail into a, you know, into a stud, or yeah, to a stud. Or,
yeah.
Anyway, you've told several, but what is your, if you were at a dinner party and there's a lull in the conversation and there's been some good stories battered around, what's your, do you have a go-to? It doesn't have to be funny. It can be meaningful, but it can be funny. What's your go-to story that you just really like to tell?
You get to give me a second to think on this.
Yeah, take your time.
I'm
in sales, so I embrace silence.
Probably depends a little bit at the time. I have low impulse control, mm-hmm. which has caused me to end up in some really interesting situations. Not just in terms of my acting out.
Yeah.
Do you ever do things that you think are going to be fun? I don't know why this one just came to mind. But back in 1979, a friend of mine and I decided that we would go snow camping.
Okay.
I don't know why we thought this was a really good idea. So we made our own snowshoes and we climbed Hermit's Peak in New Mexico on Super Bowl weekend.
Okay.
And it was quite the climb. And I remember getting up there and Chris, it's cold. I mean, we're talking, it's really cold.
Yeah. And middle of January, man.
It's middle of January. We're up at altitude of about 13,000 feet. And I didn't consider this, all our water was frozen and it had been quite a hike. All we had that wasn't frozen was we'd gotten a Cepacol bottle. You remember Cepacol? It's an old mouthwash. It was awful.
Okay. Oh, okay.
But
yeah,
it was
yeah,
a plastic
yeah.
bottle and we'd filled it up with Jack Daniels. And so the only thing not frozen was our Jack Daniels. Well, the problem is you could not drink Jack Daniels when it's that cold because it would burn you, right? And my friend that I was hiking with, Lynn Harms, I'd kill him to this day for this. Anyway, I couldn't get his stove lit. He could light his stove, but he was so exhausted, he finally just said, we've got to stop. So he just started putting up the tent right in the middle of the trail. And I said, dude, we can't pitch a tent in the middle of the trail. And he said, who else is going to come up here? I mean, we're the only idiots in the world up here. So we camped, and I never got the stove lit, so I never could melt any snow and got the stove lit. And so I'm dying of thirst. I go to bed, but the next morning, I've got to really take a leak. It was awful. So I get up, and then I thought, I was in such a hurry, I did not put the snowshoes on. So I walk outside the tent about 10 feet. I fall through the crust of the snow, and I come up to my shoulders. I mean, I'm in my...
Ooh.
Yeah, I am in, all that's showing is my head. And so I started yelling for Lynn and wake Lynn up, and he comes out and I said, hey, put your snowshoes on. Anyway.
Good advice.
Yeah, we almost, and we finally, we made it back down. And that may not be the funniest story, but it was really a great story of survival that we even got back down. The worst thing was, we were trying to listen to the Super Bowl on the way home, and I'm in a 1972 Volkswagen Bug. And the signal kept going in and out. Remember how it used to do in the AM up in the mountains there? Yeah. And we'd hear a little of the Super Bowl. We'd stop if we ever caught a signal and listen to a little bit of the game and then keep on going. But
that's crazy.
I will tell you that Cepacol bottles, those plastic bottles, don't do good with bourbon because you put that mouthwash flavor in the bourbon.
Yeah.
So even after it got warm, we still couldn't.
That's fantastic. Do you remember who played in the Super Bowl?
Do you know, I don't. It wasn't Dallas that year.
Yeah. So I was wondering if it was like the Cowboys and Broncos or something like that. But that
that's what happened later. After I got up to Denver.
That's amazing.
For grad school.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Oh, I loved it. I had John Elway up there. That was so much fun when he came in.
Oh, man. That's fantastic. Rick, thank you so much, man. This has been an absolute blast. And for those of you who are listening, he did not know these questions coming in. I literally just rapid fire through some questions I had come up with. And it was like you were prepared because you've been doing this for so long and you've been doing it well for so long. Really.
And I
want to
pitch this book.
Yeah.
This is a great book. Anybody, it's called Transformational Recovery. Highly recommend it.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate that. Very kind. I'll make sure I have your Venmo for payment later for the advertising. No, I really appreciate that. Been super fun, Rick. Thank you so much. Rick, thank you for your honesty, wisdom, and the work you've poured into supporting couples and men through one of the deepest relational wounds there is. Man, infidelity doesn't have to be the end of a man's story, though. It's not the end of his identity, his relationship, his ability to love again with integrity. And for anybody listening, if you want more support after this conversation, please visit affairrecovery.com. They're a fantastic ministry and organization. Explore the Affair Analyzer, Recovery Library, and all the online courses they offer. They are designed to meet you where you are and help you take the next right step. I've known several couples and friends that have gone through this, and it's fantastic. Thanks for listening to the Purity Podcast. If this episode was helpful, please consider subscribing, sharing it with someone who's fighting the battle for sexual purity, and/or leave a review so that others can find us. Until next time, stay honest, stay humble, and keep pursuing transformation. And remember, as you go along this journey of recovery, you are not walking alone.